The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to That's a Laugh. This is Jennifer Green with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. And speaking of chuckles, are you someone who likes to make people laugh? Do you have a natural talent to tell an amusing, interesting, engaging story? Or maybe you have had a bunch of extra time on your hands resulting from the social distancing guidelines of late? Have you ever considered becoming an author of humorous literature but just aren't sure what it takes to make your work stand out? Well, you are in luck. Today's stories offer examples of what it is like to be a writer, in true TAL fashion, of course. Learn what to do when your books are not exactly well-received from fellow writers and author megastars, how to give back to the readers with whom your books are well-received, and, of course, insight into the writing process so your writing stands a better chance of being received at all. First, let's have a few words of wisdom about the writing process from writerblueprint.com, which offers invaluable advice for getting started and keeping momentum when you write. Like these words from English playwright and novelist Somerset Maugham. There are three rules for writing. Unfortunately, no one can agree what they are. A suggestion from an anonymous author. Being a good writer is 3% talent, 97% not being distracted by the internet. And author Terry Pratchett. There's no such thing as writer's block. That was invented by people in California who couldn't write. But what is the best way to write? Mindy Kaling tells us what works for her. From her book, Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me and Other Concerns, published in 2011, the chapter, How I Write. I live in a Spanish-style house in an area of Los Angeles near The Grove. The Grove is an outdoor shopping extravaganza with a fountain that shoots jets of water synchronized to Cool in the Gang songs. People love to hate on The Grove, but it's insanely popular. It's the mall equivalent of the Kardashian family. So that's my neighborhood, and I have a cute little house in it. I really love it. I bought my house during the famous writer's strike of 2007. You, of course, remember the strike because it was over the hot-button and nationally polarizing issue of percentage of internet residuals accrued from online media in perpetuity. Doesn't thinking about it now just make your blood boil? Obviously, no one outside of a small group of professional writers really gets what was going on there. But the point is, I had a lot of time to do nothing but work and hemorrhage my savings. When I wasn't Norma ringing it up on the picket line, I spent the rest of my time decorating my house to look like something out of Architectural Digest, a kind of Santa Barbara meets artsy old lady vibe. I think I did only an adequate job, but I did manage to avoid some typical L.A. house pitfalls. I'm proud to say I don't have a single vintage poster of some old-timey French product or a statue of Buddha. But what I'm most proud of is my beautiful office. I built it and decorated it, and then I promptly never used it again. It's important to me to have a museum-quality office, so when people or potential biographers come over, they think that's where I write. No, where I really write is here. When I write, I like to look like I'm recovering from tuberculosis. I sit in bed, my laptop resting on a blanket or a Notre Dame sweatshirt on my lap, or Notre Dame sweatshirt on my lap. I got the sweatshirt when I was there doing stand-up in 2006, where I bombed, by the way. Those kids hated me and my long matronly rants about against low-rise jeans. I did a three-college comedy tour with my office co-star, Craig Robinson, who is hilarious, and a pro at performing at colleges. He plays the piano in his act, incorporating medleys of hit pop songs, and then does a rendition of an original song he wrote called take your panties off. I don't need to tell you that it's very funny, and all the college kids wished he'd partnered up with a different office cast member. The blanket/sweatshirt keeps the laptop from getting too hot and radiating my ovaries, which everyone knows makes your children come out with ADD. I almost always write alone in my house. I never have music on, because I can't concentrate with Nelly Furtado remixes thumping, and, unfortunately, I have only dance music on my iPod, which is how I got to be such a great dancer. The main reason I enjoy working on a writing staff is because of the social nature of the job. To put it kindly, I am a very talkative, social person. To put it less kindly, I'm a flibbertigibbet, which is what my frenemy Rainn Wilson calls me. It's always been incredibly challenging for me to put pen to page, because writing, at its heart, is a solitary pursuit designed to make people depressoids, drug addicts, misanthropes, and antisocial weirdos. See every successful writer except Judy Blume. I also have a nice office at work, but I use it primarily as a messy closet. The internet also makes it extraordinarily difficult for me to focus. One small break to look up exactly how almond milk is made, and 4 hours later I am reading about the Donner Party and texting all my friends. Did you guys know about the Donner Party and how messed up that was? Text me back so we can talk about it. I've found my productive writing to screwing around ratio to be 1-7. So, for every 8-hour day of writing, there is only one good productive hour of work being done. The other 7 hours are preparing for writing, pacing around the house, collapsing cardboard boxes for recycling, reading the DVD extra pamphlet from the BBC Pride and Prejudice, getting snacks lined up for writing, and YouTubing toddlers who learned the single ladies dance. I know. Isn't that horrible? So basically, writing this piece took me the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Enjoy it accordingly. Listeners, whether it takes you many months, or many, many months, after you've written your masterpiece, don't forget to thank your, hopefully, many readers. And how to do that? We just so happen to have a suggestion that serves as a double treat in this time of no less than 6 feet apart from each other restrictions. Hugs. Lots of hugs. From the book, I Need a Lifeguard Everywhere But the Pool, written by Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella, published in 2017, Lisa's chapter, 1,200 of My Closest Friends. I've got good news to report for the world. People are awesome and getting even better. How do I know this? Because of a completely unscientific study conducted every October at my house in the form of a massive party for complete and total strangers. Here's how it works. As you may know, when I'm not writing fun stories like these, I write novels that involve murder, mayhem, and the Philadelphia suburbs. They're fictional. Allegedly. Specifically, I write 3 books a year. A standalone that published in April, one of these fun books with Francesca in July, and an installment in the Rosato and D'Annunzio series, which comes out in August. I'm the Jekyll and Hyde of authors. Dark Lisa writes thrillers. Light Lisa writes jokes. So whatever your mood, read me. I can make you happy or homicidal. Just ask Thing 1 or Thing 2. I'm happy to say that book clubs read my books. So, to encourage and reward such exemplary behavior, Francesca and I host a party in October for book clubs who have read my last April book. The party is at my house, since Mother Mary taught me that the best way to show people that you care about them is to have them over and feed them carbohydrates. We started the party 11 years ago, when only 100 people came. Only. Now we've grown to a 2-day party with 600 book club members each day. That's 1,200 guests total, which is approximately 20 quadrillion, 283 trillion, 829,012,938,383 carbohydrates. I live on a farm, so I have plenty of room to accommodate everyone, except for my dogs and cats, who are imprisoned in various bedrooms for the weekend. Francesca's dog, Pip, is permitted at the party, since he's the only one with manners, obviously, because he has a better mother. To get to my point, if you invite 600 people to your house, the only way to greet them properly is to hug them. I'm a hugger. So is Francesca. And what that means, in terms of the book club party, is that we hug every guest when he or she arrives. By the way, men come to the book club party too. I personally enjoy hugging them very much. But they don't smell as good as the women, who are positively fragrant. Now, in terms of my unscientific study, I am here to report to you that 11 years ago, when I started hugging unsuspecting book club members, they didn't know how to react. Some looked startled. Others simply drew away. They weren't expecting to be hugged by a complete stranger, which is a thoroughly reasonable expectation. Plus, they'd only read the Dark Lisa books, so they didn't know what to do when Light Lisa tackled them with love. There were plenty of awkward hugs. An awkward hug is the worst thing ever. You know how it goes. One person is the hugger and the other person gasps for oxygen. I've had marriages that were one long awkward hug. Boy, bye. But over the years, I've noticed that people at the book club party have started hugging back. And not only that, they want to be hugged. In fact, our most recent book club party was this past weekend, and many book club members said, "Where's my hug?" And these weren't people who had been to the book club party before, but were book club party virgins. They had never met me or Francesca, but they were happy to be hugged, and we all hugged each other like crazy. And I'm telling you, this is a change that I have seen over 11 years. Either we need more love, or we're giving more love, but either way, this is a miraculous and wonderful improvement for all mankind, womankind, and bookkind. By the way, if you're wondering how long it takes to hug 600 people, the answer is 2.5 hours. That means I got and gave 5 hours of hugs this past weekend, and I'm betting it will add 5 hours to my life. And seriously, folks, if you ask me the reason that I not only read books but write them, it's to connect with people. That's the highest and best purpose of the arts. And I believe there is nurturance, happiness, and love in that human connection. Book clubs are a way for people to connect to each other through a book, forming a soul-to-soul bond that can become a friendship lasting 10, 20, and even 30 years. I've seen it happen. And if you're in a book club and you agree with me, let me hear from you. And if you're not in a book club, why not start one? Then come over to my house and get a hug. Love is better than hate at all times. Oh, listeners, I hope you can feel my virtual hug coming to you across these audio and digital waves. Okay, so we've covered the writing process. We've tackled how to give back to your fans. So what happens when you've reached a certain level of fame and hope to share your success with other writers? Or at least hope they share some of theirs with you. Celia Rivenbark shares her experiences in her book, She Drives Me Crazy, 3 Favorite Essays, published in 2011. Excerpts from the chapter, Bitter, Party of Me. Now that Oprah has announced the end of her long-running talk show, who, pray tell, is going to scream the names of celebrities in that annoying fashion? You know what I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, John Travolta! And who is going to give hour-long shout-outs to thick, thoughty novels that make my head hurt when I read them? No one? Oh, okay. As loyal readers know, I have sent my books to NOPRA for many years now. Frankly, as native Southerners who share having grown up in towns so small they could best be described as two stores, two whores, and a cotton gin, Oprah and I should have a lot in common. I was expecting that at least she'd send me an autographed picture or something. To Celia from Oprah. But nada. Bupkis. Zilch. So to Oprah, let me just say thanks for, nothing. O has clearly forgotten that Southerners always send thank you notes. There's more than a grain of truth to the old joke that the only reason Southern junior leaguers don't participate in orgies is that there would be too many thank you notes to write. Oprah received a gift from me, several, actually, over the years, and still no note. To put it in terms she can understand, there are no excuses. And that includes, but is not limited to, such afflictions as thoughtless billionaire syndrome, yes, I'm all that atosis, or even my vajayjay's on the fritz and I can't be bothered itis. Oh, I just hate sounding so bitter. But 10 years of mailing books to my Southern sister has taken its psychic toll. I realize how petty it must sound to constantly complain that O hasn't done me a solid. But I've been in this writing business for a while. I've paid my dues, and I've been a mentor for dozens of aspiring writers. And by mentor, I mean I've told them not to be jerks and quit their day jobs. The truth is that you don't go into this business for the money. You go into writing because you can't imagine doing anything else, because the words wake you up at night, and most important of all, because it's probably the only job in the whole world you could do while seated on the toilet. People often ask me, how come you don't sweat much for a fat girl? No, that's not what I meant to say. Although it is so totally true, and in fact, it is what I am most proud of in this life. I mean, raising a child to be a kind, caring, and productive member of society is fine, but this low sweat thing is a really big deal. Just saying. No, what I meant to say is that they ask me how I stay so disciplined. Writing can be such a solitary business that it's not for everyone, and you have to be prepared to steel yourself against all the inevitable distractions when you work from home. For instance, this morning I have become preoccupied with trying not to take it as a bad omen that for the past 3 hours there has been a white, adult-sized casket sitting on the back of a flatbed truck parked right in front of my house. It's just sitting there. No driver, no sign of life. Just sitting out there in front of my house, gleaming in the sunshine with its little carved white rosettes on the side. Okay, I believe you can see how easy it is to get off task unless you use a few tricks to stay focused on your writing. But you try to concentrate with a casket staring at you all morning. Oh, hell, here comes the garbage truck. If whoever belongs with that white casket messes up my once-a-week pickup and I have to smell these shrimp shells for another second, I'll personally dig her up and kill her all over again. Then again, it could be that one of my neighbors just bought a casket for later. You can get them at Costco and Sam's Club, you know, right there beside the 100-count packages of pork on a stick. Oh my God, where was I? Yes, disciplined writing. I think it's a good idea to write at least 10 pages a day. I mean, I've never done that, but it sounds like a really good place to start, doesn't it? Once you've gotten published, it's important not to let it go to your head. Don't do dumb stuff like if someone calls you by your first name, say, that's Mr. A-hole to you or whatever. People hate that. It's very important, karma-wise, to always be willing to give a hand up to another writer whenever, however you can. Naturally, this doesn't apply if the writer is better than you. I mean, that's food off your table. You feel me? The truth is, I've always wanted to be one of those classy writers that heaps genuine praise on all my published friends. I want to gush and ooze heartfelt wishes that their Amazon ranking never rises above 1,000. I want to be that person, but it's hard. The truth is that I'm always a bit jealous when a writer friend's book does better than mine, which happens a lot, since you ask. Sometimes, though, I try to do the right thing. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was attending the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance convention in Orlando. About 15 of us author types were doing what amounted to speed dating. We'd already speed eaten a couple of tiny ham and cheese on yeast roll thingies before being told to work the crowd, spending exactly 10 minutes at each table, charming and chatting up bookstore owners from across the Southeast. All of the other authors were familiar to me. We'd traveled in the same circles more than once. It wasn't, as they say, my first trip to the rodeo. But there was a shy, quiet fellow at our author's table. As we wolfed our mini subs and got ready to rumble, I decided it was my Christian duty to make this man feel welcome. I dragged him into the table conversation, but he barely made eye contact. Poor little fella, I thought. He's so overwhelmed by all of us big shots. Clearly, he was a book convention virgin. Is it enough to say that I talked the poor man's ears off, sharing my sort of vast knowledge of all things regional book tour? Is it enough to say that he listened quietly and politely even, at one point smiling a tiny bit? Is it enough to say that all of a sudden the chairman of the convention walked up and began to talk to the poor soul, earnestly complimenting him on his Pulitzer and his National Book Award? Oh, I thought, now realizing that on top of everything else, I'd been talking to him with a big mustardy breadcrumb affixed to my bottom lip. Just let me take my impossibly dumbass and lumber across the room to charm the book buyers, who by now were all a-twitter about having such a distinguished guest in their midst. Him, not me. Pay attention. I'm not being small when I say I can't recall the man's name. They say the mind truly forgets truly intense pain. Since that awful day, I've chatted up a few famous author types, including David Sedaris and the late John Updike. And no, I didn't ask Updike to detail my car or mistake Sedaris for a hungry drifter and offer to buy him a Hardee's thick burger, which, let's be honest, he really looks like he could use, bless his precious nicotine-ravaged heart. I did give Sedaris an advanced copy of my book and asked him if he would consider pretty please writing a tiny blurb. It would mean so much, I stammered. And by so much, I was already thinking ahead to how, if I sold enough books, we might finally be able to afford to close in a porch off our bedroom and make it into a huge walk-in closet, because, as I told Dave, we have virtually no closet space in our 90-year-old fixer-upper, and I know how gay men can sympathize with something as heart-wrenching as an abysmal lack of sufficient closet space. He listened to this with an air of amused detachment, as though, in his mind, he was already back at his French villa with his lover Hugh, sipping Turkish coffee and pondering his next seven-figure advance. Yes, just a couple of words from Sedaris and my life could change forever. When I finally shut up, he, as nicely as any human could ever do it, looked me in the eye and said, "No." David Sedaris explained that, basically, he got requests like mine all the time, and he only writes blurbs for two authors a year, and then only for people he knows personally. "But I'm in your genre. You might even like it. I will pay you whatever you want." And then, just as quickly as he'd appeared, David Sedaris was ushered away to his next book tour stop, and I stood alone in the lecture hall at the local college, feeling very small and insignificant, rather like I imagine his wing-wing to be. 3 years ago, my book made it to the final five in a national humor writing contest. Sedaris won. Did he remember the nervous but curiously non-sweating woman from his very own North Carolina who had tried to press that book into his bony little hand claws just one short year ago? Oh, I'm sure not. Ditto another book a couple of years later. Oh, what's this? You really think John Stewart and his gazillion member staff is more deserving? Well, go on with your bad self. This past summer, my most recent book made it to the top three in the category of Best Nonfiction Book of the Year in the South. But what's this? Another Pulitzer winner beat the snot out of me to take that one? And yes, I hate him just a little bit. Kidding! I'm sure he's a delightful fellow, and there's absolutely no truth to the rumor that below the neck he isn't covered entirely in scales. Oh, High Road, you're just so overrated. And that, dear listeners, is how you become a famous writer. Easy peasy. Finally, I leave you with these final words of writer wisdom found on writerblueprint.com. American novelist E.L. Doctorow reminds us, writing is a socially acceptable form of schizophrenia. American writer of speculative fiction C.J. Chera cautions us, it's perfectly okay to write garbage as long as you edit brilliantly. And good old Dr. Seuss kindly admonishes, so the writer who breeds more words than he needs is making a chore for the reader who reads. That's all we have time for today. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you for listening to this episode of That's a Laugh. I hope you will join me again next time. In the meantime, please stay safe and healthy. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the initial broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. North Carolina Reading Service, reading words into your life since 1983. The North Carolina Reading Service, NCRS, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service, is a 24/7 news and information service reading newspapers, magazines, and other forms of printed material for people who are blind or print impaired. And remember, you can now listen to NCRS on Amazon Echo. Simply say, Alexa, tune in NC Reading Service, and you will hear our broadcasts instantly. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any amusing quotes or anecdotes you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us. We'd love to hear from you at 919-832-5138. That number, one more time, is 919-832-5138.